Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Cultimatum fans, before we dive into today's episode, we need a tiny favor from each of you.
That's right. If you love what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple and Spotify.
Your support helps us to reach new listeners and bring more awareness and attention to these important topics.
So tap that star rating, drop a quick review, and help us spread the word. It really does make a difference.
Thank you so much for tuning in and for your amazing support. We truly appreciate each and every one of you. Now let's get started with the show.
Here we go. Welcome to the Cultimatum Podcast, the culture of cults and human trafficking. And my name is Anonymous Andrew. And tonight with me is my co-host Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you. And today we are joined by Vanessa Wild, a courageous voice shedding light in the dark realities of growing up in the Hare Krishna movement. From a young age, she was separated from her parents, a core teaching of the group that claimed love, family love, was a perversion and distraction from the devotion to God. Vanessa is now deconstructing her experience in a public way, using social media to share the painful truths of a childhood spent in isolation and indoctrination. She's challenging the harmful narrative that she was raised with and reclaiming her story. Vanessa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
Yeah, and before we start, I just realized I have heard of the Hare Krishna since I was 10. When we would go to the airports and the malls and everywhere, and there they were in their long gowns, and you could tell them right away that they were, there's the Hare Krishna. However, I know nothing about them. So this is going to be a very educational episode. So Vanessa, start where you'd like, and I can't wait to hear this.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, the Hare Krishnas are sort of out of everybody's mind lately. There's other cults and other stories that have come to kind of take on the headlines. But our story, I think, is really important, and I'm happy to share it. My parents were your quintessential hippies in the early 70s. They were young and passionate and idealistic and had this idea that they did not want me to grow up in this sort of mundane, capitalistic, you know, money-hungry society. And they wanted me to grow up in a more elevated way, which the intention is lovely. They were very young and naive also. My dad was a musician. My mom was just this creative, amazing creative woman. And she was 18 when they, or 19 when they had, when she had me. My dad was 21 or 22. And at that time, there was a lot of disruption in society. And there were people seeking different ways to have families and to do things in a less violent and sort of greedy way, right? So it taken me a long time to find the understanding and forgiveness for what happened. And kind of goes back to when they were in Boston. That's where they first met the Hare Krishnas. And again, you know, the time was very naive in some ways. The Beatles were coming up. They had gone to India. My dad, being a musician, was just enthralled with some of the music. And the Beatles are the ones that sort of promoted this Hindu cult in a way. early back then, well, I think at the time I was just two. And my parents, we were in Boston, and they introduced me to the food, which everybody who has ever been to a Hare Krishna temple knows that the food is absolutely amazing. And so it's sort of their first like hook, right? And by all accounts, the initial intention was good. Great food, amazing people singing and dancing and chanting, and this love of God, this bhakti yoga. By the time I was four, my brother had been born, and I was one of the first groups within my little community in Miami to be sent away to school. And the schools are called Gurukula. Gurukula is really the school of light, the school of knowledge. And in Indian tradition that we were practicing was where you would actually send the children away from the parents, essentially disconnecting that familial cord and kind of taking all that energy and focus, both from the family and the kids, and devoting that to God or the service of God. And I don't think anyone intended for what happened, but it was handled with such, I think, negligence and naivety that it put the children and the community at risk for what eventually turned out to be a very abusive and toxic environment. So the first school I went to, I was 4 years old, and we were living in Miami, and my mother brought me to this school in Dallas, Texas, where she left me there with the ashram. And none of us knew any of the people that we were going to. I didn't know any of the people that I had been handed off to. My first memory was being at the temple, sitting in my mother's lap during like the 4 a.m. worship, and being told to get off her lap, that I was no longer able to sit on my mother's lap. And I remember the pain of that and feeling not that she was abandoning me, but that they were kind of ripping us apart. And when she left the school, the next memory I have is standing in front of the Dallas Temple, just absolutely hysterical. I'd never been apart from my mother, not even maybe for a night I had spent with my grandmother. And this is the kind of separation that they encouraged the parents to buy into and the community bought into as something that was sacred. And that's something that was good for the kids. I was in Dallas for a few months without my parents, and we talked to them every Sunday, but that was the only communication we were allowed to have with our parents. And to me, at that time, again, I had never been separated from my mom and dad. We were very close-knit. We had grandparents. I had a little brother. And the part about this that I found so painful is that my mother was the one that was dropping me off at these schools. And this continued several times over the years at different schools. And so that left us very vulnerable, us kids, extremely vulnerable. Dallas had some incredible atrocities. There were children that were put in washers and dryers and locked in closets, locked in basements. I was not one of those kids, but it was the first time that I was hit physically. And that was a repeated punishment for anything you did, whether it was sitting still, not eating the food that you were served, being a little kid and talking back. It was a very swift smack in the face repeatedly, and other body parts being hit. And so that to me was the introduction to the ashram in Dallas.
I do have a quick question. I mean, not that either one is good, but are you talking about washers and dryers running? Like, were they on?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. That sounds like a death sentence.
The children in Dallas were unfortunately sort of the experiment, the beginning of the experiment, so to speak. And there's records and books written about this, of the level of abuse that was experienced in Dallas.
Was this something these children survived? Did they survive this?
Children survived. They got through, many of the kids got through high school. Sadly, we've had several folks who've committed suicide as a result of their trauma, whether it was in Dallas or India or Los Angeles or you name it, any of the schools. There's been several kids whose trauma and pain was too severe afterwards. And the sad part about this, too, is that a lot of these parents, my parents, I felt did care, but they were naive. There are parents that used the Hare Krishna movement sort of as a babysitter and became very disengaged from their kids and did not follow up, did not check in. And a lot of these children were just left at the mercy of total strangers.
And this was part of the teaching, and this was the abuse was happening across the board then, around global.
Global. across the board. And I find that's what is so terrifying, is to think that they're in this conversation that they were having about this being the pathway to God, to worship Krishna, that the abuse was not just at one school. It was every school, and almost every kid experienced these high levels of abuse.
Vanessa, two questions. Krishna, like in the house of Yahweh, I think Yahweh meant Jesus or something like that. Sorry, Melody, I should know
that's
that.
That's okay. God. Yahshua. God, Jesus.
Okay. God. What Krishna meant what?
So Krishna in Indian mythology is God, Vishnu, sort of reincarnated in this adorable, little, beautiful, very dark skin. So dark his skin was blue, like a monsoon cloud.
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. And listen, the art is gorgeous and the stories are interesting. So Krishna was the god that we prayed to, that we worshiped. There were several other deities that we worshiped, but Radha and Krishna is the primary sort of couple, and Krishna being the main person that we would say our prayers to or chant about or offer food to.
And this is going to sound silly, but Hari or Hari Krishna, it wasn't Harry, H-A-R-R-Y. It was, how did you spell Harry?
H-A-R-E.
And that meant what?
You know, it's funny that you say that. When I've gotten so accustomed to just saying Hare Krishna that I think I'm kind of out of it at this point. I think that Hare Krishna was just saying
holy.
God's name. Yeah, like in a holy way. So it's, and we would chant the Hare Krishna mantra, which is, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. So it's really chanting the divine. And I feel like I'm going to have to like look it up and remind myself. Because, you know, as a kid, you just do things. There's a lot of mantras that I have in my head or songs that we sang that I sometimes now, and I think, oh, thank God for the internet, because it was so great to be able to go, what the heck was I actually singing? What was I actually praying about? You know?
Well, I think it's great that you have come so far or in your deconstruction that you don't remember some of this stuff. That's great, because that means you have left it behind you. And if it just kind of rolled off your tongue, like you knew that, to me, that tells me you have removed yourself so far from this, that some of it is spotty. Your memory is spotty. I just want to go back to the abuse. So you're with your mom all these years, you and mom have a great bond, right? And then she drops you off at these schools, and that's when the abuse started, which, of course, we hear about these stories, not just in cults, but in many mainstream daycare nurseries and schools where kids are beaten and abused. You said something to the effect of we were hit or beaten, and then you said something in other areas of the body. I don't want you to have to describe like in detail, but were these like paddles? Were they whips? Were they slaps across the face? Yeah.
Was good old fashioned body to body, like smack across the face, smack on the legs, smack on my arms. And then the sad part about this is my mother broke her own heart by sending us away to school. And in that heartbreak and in that internal conflict, she became like that as well. So some of the harshness was I experienced, not only did I experience that in school, but to then to come home to a mom who by all accounts should be loving and gentle and in the spirit of God, but had become very, very intense with me as well. So there was this deep disconnect from the gentle, loving, you know, fun, creative people and parents that I had and experienced to a mother who, and particularly a mom. My dad was a very different character in this story. But my mother really had a hard time.
Where do you think she picked this up?
You know, I think my mom's childhood was rough. She was one of seven children born to, you know, parents who were Irish Catholics. They went to Irish Catholic schools. So, you know, she got her knuckles whacked. My papa was an alcoholic. And I think there was a lot of sadness and heartache in the family also. And so I think that her anger, her sadness, her trauma was then somehow supported in the Hare Krishna movement. I mean, I could say that most of the people in the Hare Krishna movement, you know, seem to be very sad, angry people. And that's just an observation. I don't know I can't say that's 100% true. But to have the level of abuse and the level of parents who disconnected from their kids and kind of had this inversion of spirit, so to speak, and this distortion of love that they were able to sort of keep, you know, it was just a whole environment of abuse was supported.
I have a quick question. You said when you would come home from school, I assume these were like boarding schools where you were there for long periods of time. So would you go home for like a summer break or were you going home at the end of the day?
Yeah, we were at boarding school. So the schools I went to were in Dallas, Seattle, Philadelphia, New York, Tennessee. And then my parents' home base was in Miami. So it would be a number of months, and there was never really a structure to it in terms of when we got to go home. We went home typically twice a year on average, and then the rest of the time we were at school. But that could be dependent on whether or not one of the schools closed, like Dallas school closed down. So I went in September and the school closed, I think it was in December. So even though I was only there for a few months, then once that school closed, I went back to Florida for a few months and then went off to another school in Seattle. That school eventually closed down and then I went off to another school.
Okay. So your childhood, and I don't know that age matters, but I'm guessing around 4, 5, 6, your mom dropped you off at this boarding school. And at some point when that, I don't know if that ended or when did you come back home and live with your mom?
Yeah, good question. And Dad. So I went to school. The first school I went to was when I was 4. So I had turned 5 in September. So I was there prior to turning 5 and then turned 5. Then I came back to Miami once that Dallas school had closed. I came back to Miami for a time. And then when I was somewhere, I don't know the exact time frame, but between 5 and 6, then I was sent to Seattle. And that So then that was another time. So I had time with my mom, my brother, and my dad. And then there was this next level of separation. And this was where I was very fully aware. I was aware at 4 of her leaving, but this was a whole new level that was very disruptive and traumatizing. My memory was sitting in the playground just screaming and one of the older girls comforting me under the monkey bars, sitting there in the sand and just sobbing. And that was the first time I felt not just sad, but angry. And I never forgot her like walking away from me and just being in complete shock that this was happening again. But then life carries on, right? Now I have all these people I'm around and we have a very structured upbringing. We went to bed at 7 o'clock. We woke at night. We woke up at 3:30 in the morning. We had worship at 4 a.m. We took cold showers every morning. We never, ever were able to take hot showers. So we had a very rigid, almost like a monk in training lifestyle, where from 4 a.m. to 7:30, 8 a.m., we were in worship and different types of prayer throughout the morning. Then we would congregate for breakfast, and then we'd go on for school. We did have studies. We read. We did mathematics. We did all the things. And so that went on for another year. I turned 7 in Seattle, and Seattle was where I was, you know, when you're that age, you start to kind of pop, you come to life a little bit. And Seattle was where some really tragic things had happened that kind of set the tone for the next few years. As little girls, we, you know, were kids and we always slept on the floor in sleeping bags. We didn't have beds. We just all would bring our sleeping bags and we'd roll them out and pick them up every morning and then every night. And there was a time in Seattle where we had several of us had like peed in our beds, you know, like little kids do. And the teachers instructed us to mop the floors, to clean up our own pee. And it was a very traumatic experience because we were sort of dragged through the urine. And so there's that sense of humiliation and sense of just being degraded. You know, and I know parents, people can say like, oh, you know, kids pee, but you don't like make the kids wipe it up and scream at them or yell at them during that time. During that time, at one point, we were eating also. They would make sabji, which is like vegetables and all the different mixes of spices and veggies. And for the most part, it was okay. But I had had okra one time and I had thrown up the okra and I was forced to eat the okra because in throwing it up, I was offensive to Krishna.
That's disgusting. Disgusting. So from your memory, obviously, because we're going back a ways, when does did some of the Hare Krishna indoctrination start to really affect you and or begin with you? You were going to school, like you said, you were learning mathematics and stuff, and you had these worships in the morning. What were they teaching you? What was the indoctrination?
The indoctrination was that we were servants, girls and guys, but for younger girls, we were indoctrinated with the idea that we were servants of God. And that we were also servants to men, that we were, you know, there's the spiritual part, right? That we're reincarnated, that we choose our path, that everything that happens to us is our karma or consequence for whatever we might have done in our last life. But really in this life was that we were less than. We were subservient to men. We were not good enough. We were sit in the back of the room. I mean, as early as 6 and 7 years old, we were indoctrinated with the idea that women were sort of like fire and men were like butter. So it's this kind of victim abuser mentality. But the truth was that made women responsible for men's fall down. So any bad behavior that men exhibited, any sexual mispropriety or something that they would do that was abusive physically or sexually was our responsibility. It was not only our karma, but we were the cause of this fall down. And that kind of stuff was repeated even in some of the stories that seemed kind of benign, like Krishna going to the gopis, playing with the gopis in the river, and everybody takes their clothes off and jumps in the river. Well, now Krishna is, you know, stealing all their clothes and makes each gopi come to him naked, vulnerable, afraid, shy, and having to expose herself and beg for her clothes. And so there were these stories that by all accounts, someone might be like, oh, that's so fun or so cute. But in the context of how we grew up and the stuff that we grew up around our sexuality, our position in life, it felt more like a story that reinforced sort of this toxic masculine behavior.
Okay, so naturally, the next question that I always am very uneasy about asking, was there sexual abuse with the children?
There was. I fortunately was not a victim of sexual abuse in the Hare Krishna movement. I have many friends who were abused. I don't know how I got lucky. Part of the reason I came out the way I came out is because by the time I was 8 years old, I became very defiant and very loud and very vocal and very, very fighty. Like I just was ready to fight. My brother came to school when he was 4 years old and I was put in charge of him. And it was really when I saw the way he was treated that I was like, absolutely not. I became his guardian. I was the replacement mom. I had to feed him and take care of him. I was his guardian. And it's really when I started to see things and go, oh my God, you know, now it wasn't just happening to me and it wasn't just making me feel sad or bad. It was happening to him. And it changed. That's what changed for me.
I don't remember seeing children at the airports when I saw the Hare Krishnas. Were you ever sent on these recruitments? No.
My dad was one of the guys who would go to the airport and sell the books and sell the things, and he'd go with the whole crew. I went with him to the airport one time, and he accidentally left me at the Miami airport. Somebody else in the van was like, wait, where's Radhe, which is my Hare Krishna name. And my dad flipped out and was like, oh my God, we've got to go get her. So I was just standing there in the airport with the security folks like, okay, hello, this is weird. But no, we did not go to the airport. But we did go on Sankirtan, which is what the word is used to when you're going out and everybody's playing the drums and singing and you're asking for money, right? So we were recruited into that a little bit later.
Okay.
I'm just going to say, I think that
ahead, Melody.
The reason that you probably weren't abused is because you were loud and boisterous and you were going to be a tattletale.
Oh.
And they probably knew you weren't an easy target. So you probably saved yourself the sexual abuse victim because
I agree.
You just didn't. They were like, no, she's gonna be loud. She's gonna put up a fight. She's gonna tell everybody. Yeah. I think I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's a good thing. You did, I think you protected yourself without realizing it.
I did. And I mean, at the point by the time I was 11, I was so uncontrollable. This is where it got kind of funny, was like, I was constantly told, you know, you are uncontrollable or control yourself. Or they would say, like, you're walking on thin ice. And I'd be like, crack, crack, crack. Like, forget these people. You know, I organized a group called the Runaway Girls. We were called the Rags. And I was like, okay, everybody pack your rice. a pair of underwear, socks, an apple, and some popcorn from last night's dinner. So we all created these little runaway bags. And I had mapped out, you know, in my 10-year-old brain, like how to get out of the property and how to call the cops and who to go to. We all got busted, of course. But that was my first, like, I'm going to build community and I'm going to protect my people. And we are getting out of this thing together.
Let's talk about the cops for a second, because that's one of my favorite subjects with cults. So when you were at the airports and anywhere else that they recruited, you ever asked, because many places that you people go to beg for money or ask for money or try to present, it's almost like a protest. You sometimes have to get a permit, especially like if it's federal ground or airport, it's private property or something, city property. Was there ever any confrontation between, and I know you weren't at a lot of them or any of them, do you know if the cops ever kind of came along and said, hey, you got to move along, you can't be here?
Think so. Not in the early 70s anyway, because in the early 70s, this was such an experimentation. And it was an experimentation of so many different ideologies and consciousness that I don't think that anybody was bothered necessarily. And the Haris never came off aggressive. Now, in the 80s, this is where things got scammy, right? This is where people would go out and say that they were, when they were selling hats or t-shirts, they would say things that they were like, you know, feeding hungry children. It was almost like a little bit of a lie in a way. I don't know if they had permits, but it always felt pretty scammy to me. And I was very embarrassed. Like, are we begging for money? Like, what are we doing? You know? So there was a whole line that they would say, but I don't know what permits they had. I can't speak to that. I'm assuming they were a nonprofit, but again, I don't know for certain.
Because back, I grew up in the 70s and I remember the peace movement and the Vietnam War and the protesters and civil rights movements. And I guess if you were peaceful, I guess they didn't bother with you as long as you weren't causing a disruption.
Well, and they were peaceful in public, right? But the disruption was behind the scenes. The disruption.
It's like every cult.
Every cult. And, you know, people looked at a picture of me when I had this cute little picture of me at this big festival in San Francisco. And they were like, you look so happy. I'm like, yeah. Do you want to know that 2 weeks before that, I was forced to eat my vomit? Do you want to know that 2 weeks before that or a month before that, my little friend got locked out of the ashram and left in the rain screaming and crying because she wouldn't eat her dinner? Do you want to hear about the countless people that were slapped, smacked, sexually abused, had to wear urine-soaked underwear on their heads? I mean, yeah, the picture is cute, but a picture is not contextual. It doesn't say anything.
Sometimes a picture does not tell 1,000 words. No, whatever that phrase is. No.
No. And that's, you know, this is where I knew that they were aware of the abuse. There was a time in Seattle when I had called my parents after we had to clean up our urine. And I left out the part that we had to wear our pee-soaked underwear on our head as punishment. And I was so, like, scared and sad. And I had my Sunday call with my parents. And as soon as I started to tell them what was happening, they took the phone out of my hand and said, oh, she's just upset. She just misses you. So my parents, every time I tried to tell them on the phone or in a letter, that was disrupted. So then by the time I actually saw my parents, the connection was so broken because there was no real conversation. And I never talked about it until I was like 13 again. I never told them any of these things until later because I didn't think they cared. I didn't know that they knew. I didn't trust them. I didn't know them, you know, very well. I didn't feel like I did anyway.
Okay. So you mentioned 13. Take us through your teenage years.
Well, there's one part of the story I want to back up into.
Sure.
That will lead us into the teen years. So when I was 11, I was in Lake Huntington. This is one of the schools. And my brother was with me at the time. And I had gotten very disruptive. I was just angry and disgusted. I was tired of being yelled at. I was tired of being put down. I was tired of sitting in the back of the room and told what an idiot I was for being a woman. I had just gotten my period. I was very young when I got my period. I was 11. And I was just like being told I was cursed and dirty and I couldn't wear. It was just like so overwhelming as a kid. And I was so frustrated one day. I went into the bathroom and I took the biggest tube of toothpaste I could find and I squirted it everywhere in the bathroom, on the ceilings, on the floors, in the mirror. I just wanted to make an absolute disgusting mess. And that was my big rebellion. So my ashram teacher, she comes to me and she's like, why did you do that? You know, and I would just, my answer for everything was to look at them straight in the face with a smirk and go, I don't know. I don't know. And that pissed them off like to no end. So eventually after I got my runaway girl thing going and we got busted, I got kicked out of school because I was inciting other kids to stand up. I was inciting everyone to start to say like, no. And so, yeah, I got kicked out of school. So I was fine with that. I loved my friends, of course. I'd been with them, most of them, since I was four. And I went to live on a farm with my mother in Alachua. Now, during this time, my mom was going through hell as a woman in the Miami Temple. She was divorcing my dad. She had fallen in love with someone else. They, out of vengeance, had married her love to her best friend and then exiled her out of the temple. So it was just absolute manipulation. So she's now living on a farm in Alachua, and she's got this crazy 11-year-old daughter who's just like freaked out. The guru decided that because I was so uncontrollable, and the only way to control a woman was to marry her off. So they conjured up this plan to see if I was amenable to getting married. Now, I was 11. My mother handed me a laundry basket of all of these, you know, orange clothes. This is what these guys who weren't married yet wore. They wore the orange robes. And I looked at her and I said, do you want me to marry someone? And she goes, how do you know? I said, because you would never ask a woman or me or anybody to do someone's laundry if that wasn't supposed to be his wife. And my mom was shocked that I understood what was going on. Then she and this 29-year-old man proceeded to try to get me to marry him by taking me to Epcot Center. But here's the beauty of this story is I don't know how I had such a strong sense of self. I don't know how I had this in me, but I was wearing a sari, you know, and I remember this guy sitting there talking to me and saying things like, he said, well, you'll be able to eat all the cookies you want because you'll be a married woman. And I was like, well, I can already eat all the cookies I want. And he said, well, you'll have friends and everybody will know you. And I was like, I already have friends all over the world. That's not going to help me at all. And all these weird kind of creepy things he was trying to bribe me with, I was like, I don't need any of that.
Yeah, he was dangling a carrot and you had already eaten a carrot.
Well, I'm just going to add in here that these are not the ways, this is the way you get a child to marry you, not a woman. That this is creepy stuff. That is weird, creepy stuff. Yeah.
Sexual predator.
Yes.
That's a sexual predator. Yeah.
Grooming.
Come here, little girl. I have a treat for you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Fully. So we went on Space Mountain on that ride and my mom sat behind me. He sat in front and I was in the middle chair. And I remember flying around in Space Mountain, pitch black. And it was the freest I had ever felt in my life. And so when we got off the ride and they started asking me these stupid questions like, oh, you'll get cookies or you'll be popular. I felt this power in me that was so strong that when we got back to the temple, I went to there was only one phone on the temple. It was a payphone. So I called my dad, Collect, and he was living in London at the time. He had already kind of gotten out. He was done. He and my mom were splitting up and he was working in the music studio at the London Temple. And I said, Dad, you either get me out of here right now or I'm calling the cops and I will walk off this property. I will steal a car to get off this property. I do not care how it happens, but I'm out. And so fortunately, my dad had some sense and he had a good attorney and I ended up getting to choose who I was going to live with and got out of the situation.
And did you go to, you said he was overseas. Did you go overseas?
I did.
Oh, good for you. Good for you.
London with him. It was the most amazing summer. I read, do you guys remember that book by Stephen King called Firestarter?
I do. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you remember Drew Barrymore, the character, I don't remember the character's name anymore in the book, but this little character was so powerful and she was setting things on fire. And I really resonated with this just like anger and rage and this fierce protection of myself. And that summer was sort of my summer of liberation. I had my first crush on a boy that I wasn't being monitored or getting demerits for. And, you know, it was amazing. I ended up going on to the French school, to the Gurukul, which was 100 times better than the one in the U.S. But I had a teacher there who I had had in the U.S. She had come over to France also to teach. And that was really like the biggest bummer. But I was also so much more powerful at the time. And so again, I started trouble in France because we were all alive at this point. We were awake. We were really smart kids. We knew what we that being hit and yelled at and disparaged and separated from our parents was completely wrong. So at one point I told my friends, if anybody gets hit, all of us, we're hitting them back. And that's what happened. Don't hit us. We're going to hit you back. We're going to fight back now. I ended up getting kicked out, of course, of that school too for causing trouble.
I think your rebellious nature saved you from a lot of, I mean, you went through a lot to begin with, but yes, you could have gone through a lot worse. And I think your rebellious nature saved you a lot and got you out early.
It did. It did. And I think that there was this just, you know, that's the only life I had known. And so coming into this world was weird. I went to Catholic school. I had to wear a uniform. I was very unsupervised. My parental structure was completely dismantled at that point. We had come back to live with my grandmother in Fort Lauderdale. And I did not have any protection or guidance from a parental person. Even though I feel like my dad saved my life, what the situation I came into was in some ways, you know, just as awful. We didn't have steady housing. He didn't have steady work. Sometimes we lived in his car. We lived in hotel rooms. This is where I was exposed to sexual impropriety, not from my dad, but from men that were either in the hotel that we were in, a number of places. And so I ended up in many dangerous situations between the age of 12 and 16.
Was this in England?
This was here. This was in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your dad moved back.
Yeah. He moved back to Fort Lauderdale. And then when I got kicked out of school in France, then I came to live with him because there was no way I was going to live with my mother. And my dad and I always had a very easy relationship. We got along well. I thought it would be fun. I had no idea what I was in for with him. But it was the better choice of the two, even though both choices either way would have subjected me or put me up for some kind of, you know, situation that was unsavory.
What age did you officially no longer be a Hare Krishna?
Officially, I was 12 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. So this would explain why you're not, so you fully have gone through your deconstruction phase. You grew up, you had a teenage years, normal-ish. I guess I would imagine between 12, 13, 14, 15, you had to deconstruct this, but you were now in the regular world being exposed to regular things.
Yes.
I don't know how to explain it.
And the truth is I don't think this world was better. I didn't have sexual abuse when I was a kid, but I did have several very scary experiences as a teenager that was vulnerable, unprotected, unguided, unparented at that age. And so I had some very, you know, came close to several human trafficking situations in the Miami area. Again, my rebelliousness, my natural, however I got the street smarts, helped me from getting entangled in these situations. But I found myself in one weird situation after the other. And then eventually, you know, I got pregnant at 16 and ended up becoming a teen mom.
Okay, wow. Well, you know, Melody and I have interviewed many cult members who were told that if you leave the cult, it's horrible out there. And in your case, you did find that to be true. But this is the real world. There are going to be predators and pedophiles and criminals, and the underbelly of life is out there.
So, go ahead, Melody. Were your parents still in at this point, and or did they leave, and or were they, had they left when you left, essentially?
Yeah. So my dad, fortunately, he had gotten out of he was slightly out in London. He was doing music for the Hare Krishna Temple in London. But after that, he had no more, once he left there and once I got kicked out of school, there was no more communication with the Haris. We were done. My mom stayed in and ended up marrying somebody else in the movement. And she ended up having two other children, my little sisters. But she finally left when I was about 18. So she officially was like, she was done. You know, she started eating chicken and smoking pot. So she had enough.
A personal question. Did you and your mom ever have a sit down, and did she apologize to you at all?
It's an interesting question. And it's really, really, I love this so much because I have done so much work to heal and to reconcile both my parents' actions and then the traumas that I endured and then the trauma that I recreated in my life, you know, because I had all these weird patterns. My mom and I had a really complicated relationship and we loved each other fiercely. She was one of the most amazing women I know and creative person on the planet. Like, she really was an outstanding person in many, many ways. But I think she really, truly broke her own heart by sending us away to school. And we had a lot of talks. We tried to work things out, but she was not able to really go there with me. We ended up going to counseling at one point soon after she was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and we made some headway. But her terminal diagnosis sent me into just an awful depression, and I became like angry at her again. And I was so scared of losing her, and I was just so freaking mad about everything at this point that at one point right before she passed, I said to her, I'm like, did you ever even want me? And I didn't realize like the emotionality that that would bring up for both of us. And she said, of course I wanted you. And now I recognize that that was probably a cruel question to ask her. I found her journal about a month ago in my storage unit. And I've had this for 13 years. She passed a while ago. And in her journal, she actually acknowledged how she broke her own heart and how sorry she was for sending us away and that our childhoods got taken away from us. And she reflected in that journal just how tiny we were when that happened. And something shifted in me just a month ago when I read that. And I was able to completely 100% forgive her. I can still feel emotional about it. So we did have a relationship. We were very active in each other's lives while she was here. It was just hard. And I was super angry at her. But as of a month ago, I feel like I've been able to really drop in. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the postmortem apology.
And how about your dad? Is he alive?
He is. He's alive. He has said so many times, I wish we had just picked you up. He said, after we sent you to Dallas, I sat there going like, what the F did we just do? And I said, why didn't you come get me? He's like, well, because everybody was doing this. And we just, you know, he's like, but he has that regret where he wishes he had just listened to himself. My mother was a pretty powerful person and she really wanted this. She thought this was the right thing. So I think a lot of times he acquiesced to her decisions and her, you know, forcefulness, but he definitely regrets it. He wishes all the time that he could go back and bring us home. And so that to me, even though our relationship and as a result of his decisions, my life has, you know, been harder than it needed to be in many ways. There is remorse. There is an apology. And so that means something. That means a lot.
I don't know if you know the answer to this because you've been removed for many years. Where are the Hare Krishnas today? Are they around? Is there as many of them as there used to be? If you don't know, that's okay.
Yeah, strangely, there's temples all over the world. There's temples in Turkey, Russia, Georgia, China. There's Hare Krishna temples everywhere. A lot of the Indian population has become more integrated with the Hare Krishna movement now, which is bringing a different level and layer of history and culture, which I think is good for it. But, you know, there's still Sunday feasts. I'll still go sometimes once in a while to go to one of the festivals, but they are active. There was a huge lawsuit several years ago in 2006-07-ish against the Hare Krishnas, and they were forced to pay out for these grievances. And so I don't know, though, if they learned a lesson. I know that there's no more sleepaway schools. There's, you know, just like with any religion, you know, Catholics, you hear about all this abuse. Somehow, this abuse of spirit, this degradation of our humanity doesn't stop these people in their tracks. It doesn't force them to end their tenure, so to speak. They carry on, they continue. And some of it may be good, a lot of it isn't good. So yeah, they're still active, but not in the same way.
I do not see them anywhere. So, and not that I've been to the airport within the last year, but I guess they don't go there anymore. I don't know what they do.
No, they don't do stuff like that anymore. Every now and then you'll see them in Pacific Beach, like chanting and banging on drums or whatever. But no, they typically have programs at the temples. People can go. They're not as pushy. They're, you know, people have learned. People are more sophisticated.
Have they jumped onto the digital world? Do they have a Facebook page? Do they have a website? Do they have a social media?
Yeah, I don't know about social media, but they definitely have websites. There's a website for the temple in LA. There's a website for the temple in Pacific Beach. So yeah, you can go on and find festivals now. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And I always ask this to my guests and in our guests in wrapping up, and then I'm going to throw it to Melody. Where are you in your faith today?
Good question. You know, I think I have a really strong connection with whatever that higher power is. In moments where I get scared, I revert to chanting the Hare Krishna mantra really quick, like, you know, or go Krishna, not as much, but it's not because I necessarily believe in the faith. It's just kind of out of habit. But I pray, I meditate. I feel like I'm in constant commune with a higher power, whether it's the universe, spirit, or the quantum field. I don't name it. But I do feel connected.
I think 9 out of our 10 guests, they have that answer. I think it, no matter what the indoctrination they've had as children or teenagers or whatever, when they become adults, it's the same answer. And that's fine, because that's where I'm at. I believe in a higher power and I meditate. So it's safe to assume you don't believe in organized religion and you don't have a brick and mortar church that you go to. Okay. Good.
In fact, I want to leave with this, is that there's a hope for healing, and and that's not any kind of bypassing. I've done 18, 20 years of therapy, EMDR, all of the things.
EMDR is great. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have healed, and I want to leave people knowing that you can absolutely reclaim your sense of self. You can absolutely let go of the stories in the past. I'm going to take it a stretch further and tell you guys this truth, is that no matter how bad it was, I would never want to do it again, but I am very glad for the things I grew up with, which include not watching television, not eating meat. I grew up with a sistership and a connection of friends that I still have my friends from 4 years old on today. I grew up with a different worldview, a very philosophical worldview that runs very deep. And whether I was nurtured into that or that was natural, I am so thankful that I wasn't exposed to the things I was exposed to as a teenager in the real world as a child. This was crazy upbringing. I was very protected in some ways and sheltered from the bigger world, right? And because of who my parents are, I know that my life would not necessarily have been better if we were not Hare Krishnas. I would have still been hit. I still would have been exposed to weird people, right? And so I've made peace with the idea that my parents are who they are, and my life would not necessarily have been better growing up with them in the real world versus the Hare Krishna world. I think I just came to this earth and this is the hand I've been dealt, and I've made peace with that.
So you never watched the Brady Bunch or Happy Days or Laverne and Shirley? Wow.
I didn't watch television until I was 13.
Okay. That was kind of a little joke. So Melody, you have any closing questions? I know you do.
Well, I'll close with this, but I don't know if you don't, because your situation and your story is a little unique and different in this way. But the question we normally end with is that, and so I'll ask you, and if you don't, it's because you left at such a young age, but do you have any advice for somebody who might be in a cult right now and or questioning a group they're part of or questioning a group they might be thinking about getting involved in?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're older mind, you know, teenager, I think it's important to make sure that it's not infringing or impinging on your sovereignty. Are your decisions being made for you? Are you being talked out of things that are important to you? Is there ability to question authority and have open, honest conversations? Those things are super important. Do you have sovereignty in how you live your life and how you make your money, how you hold on to your money and spend your money? I think those, as an adult, we're able to make those decisions and kind of say, listen, if someone is impinging on those decisions and your sovereignty in any way, just know that that's only going to get worse if you agree to it. Right? It's a very toxic, abusive environment.
Absolutely.
I saw that happen to my mother. She agreed, and then it just got worse and worse. And the more she agreed, the more abuse, the more separation, the more violence, whether it was emotional or spiritual or financial violence, was enacted upon her. So think. Don't, just because something sounds transcendental or transcendent does not mean that it's good for your spirit, does not mean that it will elevate your soul by any means. In fact, oftentimes it breaks the heart, it breaks the spirit. So if you doubt it, if you have a question, if your gut is screaming at you, or even just a little inkling of like a doubt, fuel that doubt, not the faith in these situations. Fuel the doubt, ask questions, get an expert opinion, have someone go with you to their meetings or whatever they're doing to get you to go there. Ask a ton of questions. And if it doesn't feel right, again, or if it's impinging on your sovereignty, run as fast as you can.
I like
Vanessa,
that.
I love that. And I cannot begin to thank you enough because once again, we haven't covered the Hare Krishna, right, Melody?
No.
So again, another new cult, although it's really not a new cult. It's one of the oldest cults that have been around. But seriously, thank you so much for joining us today.
There's only one more thing I want to say before we say goodbye to her is that when you were talking about your parents making the decision about sending you and your brother to school when you were at such a young age, I'm just going to add in there that I'm glad that you've been able to forgive them, but I really think that that was more of the cult mindset, that they did not really feel they had a choice. They were being told what to do by the group, by the cult, by the leaders, by the leadership. And they were just doing what everybody else was doing in that cult because they were in that cult mindset.
Exactly. And that's the danger of it. My mother was a brilliant woman. My dad is a loving guy. They were so open-hearted people. And then they were severely manipulated into this. And that's the real tragedy, is that it did go against their own soul. It did go against their heart to live without us, to separate us. We're a family unit.
And that's a common denominator with a lot of ex-members. We hear that a lot. I heard one of our ex-guests that has a TikTok channel, she says some of the smartest and brilliant people, sophisticated, are drawn into cults. And Melody and I always like to say, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, we're going to join a cult. You join an organization that you think has the values there's no indoctrination at the beginning. It's all love bombing at the beginning, and the indoctrination comes in afterwards. So
everybody wants a sense of belonging. That is what we want. And that sense of belonging is so powerful and so incredible that it does drive us to, that's the underlying thing. A cult, a culture, a school, a university, a political party is a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's why it's just so important for people to stay true to themselves. And if it feels like it's taking away, if that sense of belonging is compliant and dependent on your giving up who you are, it's the wrong group to be part of. It's the wrong gang.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Vanessa. What a great interview. Such a unique story. And I was curious because I didn't know a lot about the Hare Krishna before doing this interview. I've learned a lot I didn't know before. So, and I will say for anybody interested that Vanessa has a TikTok account where she does talk about some of this stuff. That's actually that's how I found her, was the story about finding her mother's journal, and she was talking about it. And it was so emotional. I could see you were so real and raw in that video. That was when I reached out to her. But you can find, we'll have that link in the show notes so you can find her on social media as well. But thank you, Vanessa, so much for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And once again, we want to thank Vanessa so much for coming on the show and sharing her story with us. I did Google a couple of things after the interview here, and I'm going to say that the Hare Krishna has been a nonprofit since its inception. So I did Google that. That is the case. And that the Hare Krishna is used as a way, it's like a mantra to invoke the divine energy or power of God. So it's like a mantra they say before they say the Krishna, which is for the God I think it's God. That's right, right? It's for God. The Krishna's for God.
Yeah.
If I remember right. Yeah, that's what she said. So I Googled those two things while we were waiting in between there. And the other thing I did want to touch on is that the rebellion thing saving her is that I feel a lot like that. My rebellion saved me and my cult too. So I can relate to that. Of course, I was much older when I got in and when I got out, I went in at 15, got out at 20. But it was similar to where I ended up getting kicked out, like she essentially did, got kicked out because of my rebellious nature, because I wouldn't comply with the polygamy teaching. I got the boot. I got an official excommunication letter. So, and I think that there was a lot more abuse and damage, and the place just got a lot worse and a lot more strict after I left. And I see that, and I thought, my rebellion saved me a lot of heartache.
Yeah. And I've heard that on several, almost a majority of some of the interviews, that people got out because they fought against the establishment or whatever.
Yes.
For lack of better words.
And yes.
Let's just say it in plain English. They critically thought and they questioned what they were hearing and they didn't like that. So they got either banned or disfellowshipped or whatever, yeah. Or they left on their own. So
Exactly. Yeah. And it ends up being a good thing, right? It ends up, you know, it ends up saving them in the end. The bad attitude ends up playing in their favor. The only other thing I did want to address too. Go ahead, Andrew.
No, I was just going to say, I'm glad we had her on because when you told me Hare Krishna, it just brought back memories, vivid memories of walking in and seeing these group of hippies, because back then they were hippies,
right?
And they had these long flowing gowns and tambourines and
yep.
I see them in my mind. And folks, that was 60 years ago, so
yes.
I still remember that, you know. So
well, it must have been an unusual sight, so it stuck with you.
It was definitely weird.
So the other thing that I did want to touch on too is that I don't know if she's aware of this, but bedwetting in children can be a physical symptom of stress and anxiety. I'm guessing the reason that multiple children in these schools that were bedwetting is because they were stressed and anxious because they were pulled away from their parents. They were being slapped and abused.
And there was something else that caught my attention besides the bedwetting, which is a not natural, again, seems like these cults don't have a grasp on the human biology, that these are natural events in humans, whether it's female or male. She mentioned the menstrual cycle at 11. She got her period at 11 and she was dirty. And that was what I learned that your cult did that.
Oh,
and
yes.
This is part of biology of how we procreate.
Yes.
Except for the urinating in bed, but I peed in my bed.
Yeah.
You know, and I grew up in a pretty decent household.
Yeah.
It's just,
sometimes it has to do with sleep patterns too. I just know it can be brought on by trauma. So I'm just thinking that if there were multiple kids in these schools having this problem, it probably was because they were so stressed and anxious. Plus they were waking them up at 3 a.m. They probably weren't getting enough sleep. Their sleep cycle was probably disturbed.
Yep.
So yeah, there was all kinds of reasons in there creating some of that stress and trauma. But I will touch real quick on the menstruating thing is that our cult actually taught that women were unclean because somewhere in the Old Testament of the Bible, in the laws, it talks about, you know, women have to be separated from the camp and the group and all this stuff. It does say that in the Bible. But let's be real, we were talking about a time period before there were hygiene products.
Yeah, and the Bible was written, first of all, 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. And back then, their thinking was back-assward. So it wasn't until the last 40 or 50 years when tampons came on the scene and commercials for women's products came on the scene, and it became normal for women to talk about menstruation, even breastfeeding. It's a natural. I remember, I don't know, 15 years ago, there was all this hubbub in New York City because a woman was breastfeeding on the subway. Come on. This is, what do you think they did? 200, 300, 400. They didn't have, what's that powdered milk formula? They didn't have that back then.
Yep.
All of us were breastfed. Most of us anyway, at least in the, whatever. You're going to go, I'm going to go off on a rant and you don't want that. So,
No, but exactly. It's just one of those things where it's another way, because she said not only that, but just in general, women were degraded and being blamed for men's sin, which is common in a lot of these cults as well. So it fits in with their whole mantra. So it's frustrating for
stupid.
Me. Stupid. That's a good word for it too, Andrew. I like that. So once again, thank you so much, Vanessa, for coming on and sharing your story with us and teaching us a little bit about the Hare Krishna, which we didn't know before. And thank all of you for tuning in to Cultimatum. As always, your support is greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify, we really do appreciate that. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcasts, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can also find us on additional social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cults or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member looking for any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
You can also check out my other podcast, Digital Dating with Anonymous Andrew. If you want to hear something from me and learn about dating and relationships, head over there. If you'd like to help us out with the cost of maintaining the podcast, you can support us through the Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in our show notes. Every little bit helps in our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.